Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Matt Schiavenza. Last week, the United States and Britain said they believe that Iran carried out a deadly attack on an Israeli-linked merchant vessel off the coast of Oman. The incident, which Iran denies any involvement in, has raised tensions between Iran and Israel, whose rivalry is reshaping diplomacy in the Middle East. The two countries, as it happens, also have new leaders. On June 12th, an eight-party coalition won Israel's elections, elevating 49-year-old Naftali Bennett to prime minister. 6 days later, the hardliner Ebrahim Raisi was elected president of Iran, bringing him in close alignment with the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. In the first part of this episode of Asia in Depth, we're going to learn more about Bennett and Raisi and what their emergence tells us about where their countries and the region are going. We have two expert guests to guide us along. Ambassador Dennis Ross served as the U.S. point person for the Middle East peace process in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Karim Sajapour is an expert on Iran at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and is an Asia 21 young leader. They spoke with Asia Society President Kevin Rudd. Later, Rudd is joined by Megan O'Sullivan, an expert at Harvard University, for a conversation about the U.S. and Afghanistan. Ross begins by describing the eight parties that comprise Naftali Bennett's victorious coalition.
There are two right-wing parties. Prime Minister Bennett comes from one called Yamina, but there's another one called New Hope. So there's two right-wing parties. There is what I would call a right-of-center party, which is Israel Beiteinu, which is Avigdor Lieberman's party. There are two centrist parties, Yair Lapid's party, he is the foreign minister now, and Blue-White, and Benny Gantz is the defense minister. And then there are two left-wing parties, or at least left-of-center and left-wing parties. One is the Labor Party, headed by Merav Mikhaeli. And the last one is Meretz, which has always been seen as a not just a left-wing party, but a peace party in Israel, pretty much always limited in terms of being on the left side of the spectrum. An interesting party in the sense that it has both Israeli Jewish and Israeli Arabs who are part of it. Now that also leads to one last party, the Ram Party, which is the Islamic movement in Israel. Mansour Abbas is the head of it. And it is for the first time we've actually seen an Arab party that is part of the coalition. It's not for the first time that we've seen an Arab party play a role in terms of sustaining a coalition. That was true during Rabin's time. But even then, you did not have an Arab party that was actually a part of the coalition, had signed on to it. There were agreements that pertain to it. So this is a true national unity government. It is a government with enormous ideological diversity. On its face, it might look like it couldn't be sustainable. And surely it will face a constant set of challenges and already has. But I think to understand why it may be more durable than most people think, you have to understand the role that former Prime Minister Netanyahu played, both in terms of its formation and in terms of what I think is likely to be its an unexpected durability. What I mean by that is the following. There was this consensus across the board in Israel, left to right, that Prime Minister Netanyahu represented a challenge, a threat to Israel's basic institutions. And that's what produced this split on the right. That's what produced these two right-wing parties who decided to come together and join with parties that they never, ever would have imagined they would have been part of a coalition with. Now, the reality that Prime Minister Netanyahu seems so determined to try to bring the government down, the reality that he is the leader of the opposition, just as he created a glue that provided, in a sense, what brought them together, so long as he heads the opposition, so long as he seems so determined to try to constantly plant landmines that will bring this government down, he again helps to preserve this coalition. He is the glue that preserves the coalition. Were he to no longer be the head of the opposition, not at all clear whether this government could survive. Now, having said that, the longer it does survive, the more it begins to take on a life of its own. And one of the things that's very striking about this coalition is that you have Prime Minister Bennett, who I can only say sounds Biden-esque. His whole public demeanor is that it is time for us to treat each other not as enemies. When we have disagreements, we can discuss them. He's asked every party to basically respect the needs and the concerns of the other parties in the coalition. He said it's time for Israel, for Israelis to recognize the real threat to them comes from the kind of demonology that was being developed on the inside. So there's a kind of almost a sociological change with this government. And I think it says it's changing the character of the political discourse. Now, not from the opposition. The opposition is constantly presenting positions or resolutions of no confidence. It is adopting positions that ran completely counter to positions it had when it was in the government. There was a citizen law that it championed when it was in the government and then was against it as soon as the coalition was voting for it, the government was voting for it. So we're going to see there still is a polarization with those who are in opposition to the government, but the government itself spans the whole spectrum of Israel. And I will say I was in Israel during and after the handover. And it reminded me of what a lot of people in the United States felt after President Trump. There was a sense of relief more than anything else. And there was a sense that day-to-day politics wasn't characterized by a kind of colossal dysfunction and a preoccupation with how you could demonize who your opponents were. So we'll see. I mean, on the one hand, I'm suggesting that this may be more durable than people think just because the presence of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The real measure is going to be, do they pass the government? Do they pass the budget? By law, they have to do that. My guess is that if they succeed in doing that, and if I were to bet today, I would say I think they will. If they succeed in doing that, that may well affect the opposition. It may take, I think we're looking at maybe 5 months before we'll see that. Former Prime Minister Netanyahu promised that this government would be brought down much more quickly than people think. If it turns out that it's not, that I think will produce challenges to him in the opposition. Now, just to run quickly through some of the issues that you were raising. What does it mean in terms of the relationship with the United States, especially on an issue like Iran? What we've already seen is not that this new Israeli government is going to suddenly adopt a position that says, gee, we love the JCPOA. They're not going to do that. But the difference is they have also made it very clear differences with the United States will not be litigated in public. There will be quiet discussions. There already is a kind of instinct to adopt a position that says, you know, if the JCPOA comes back into being, that still means there's 9 years before the most important sunset provisions lapse. So we have 9 years to be working with the United States to focus on how to deal with that. There is a real belief that Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he was Prime Minister, made a fundamental strategic error in terms of not thinking about, okay, what's the alternative to the JCPOA? And adopting this kind of public posture of opposition, going back to the speech that he made in the Congress, also produced something else that this new Israeli government is determined to try to deal with, which is the loss, or at least the imagery, of Israel lost its bipartisan standing in this country. This is a government very determined to reach out to Democrats and to try to change the image and understanding that for Israel, it needed to be an American interest, not a Republican or a Democratic interest. It doesn't mean there's any less concern about the Iranians, but it does mean there is a decision made that they will work quietly with the Biden administration. They will try to work through, they'll try to explain where they have concerns, see if there are ways to address them. And from what I've seen, so far, the Biden administration is actually quite appreciative of this new government. President Biden just hosted the King of Jordan. One of the messages he came with is that there's been a kind of reconciliation with Israel because of this new government. And he gave this new government with the president high marks. Will this government be able to do a lot with the Palestinians? Not if one talks about trying to settle a conflict, but then again, the Palestinians are so divided at this point, there's very little that they could do. What this new government is, it has a slogan, which is called shrinking the conflict, which is don't just try to manage the conflict, see how you can begin to reduce it. What can you do to change the conditions on the ground? This is one area where there's a consensus within the government. There isn't a consensus within the government as to what should be the final, if you make a peace agreement with the Palestinians, what should its outlines look like? You're looking at the left wing of the party and even the center of the party that have views quite different from the right wing of the party, I mean, from the government. The right wing of the government is not in favor of a two-state outcome, although never been quite clear to me exactly what they see as the alternative to that. But clearly the center and the left wing of the government are entirely in favor of a two-state outcome. But they all understand you can't produce it tomorrow. And so the question is, what can you do to reduce the nature of this conflict, change the character of it, and make a resolution, whatever that might be, more likely? But why don't I stop there? That gives you at least a flavor of who this government is and how they might be dealing with some of the big issues.
That's fascinating. I was taken in particular by your description of the role played by former Prime Minister Netanyahu as providing the glue for this unlikely, shall we say, coalition of the willing from the centre-left to almost the far right. I know you mentioned the important milestone of the passage of the budget. What's the temperament within Netanyahu's own party to stay with him or to replace him? If you could briefly go to that one, and then I will, go to Karim on the question of Iran.
Again, there are kind of interesting parallels with the United States. The core of Likud, the backbone of the party publicly, I think is still strongly supportive of the former prime minister. Those who are possible successors are increasingly uneasy. They resisted former Prime Minister Netanyahu's desire to have a very quick primary within Likud, because they understood that he would win that. And so far, they're not moving towards a quick primary. There are rumblings, but no one's prepared to come out in public and challenge former Prime Minister Netanyahu, although they're you have a couple of Israel Katz, who's former finance minister, who made some comments that were as close to criticism as one might see coming out of Likud right now. I think that there are a group of potential successors who are biding their time right now. I think they feel that it would be political folly for them to try to take him on at this point. But if it becomes clear that his promise that this government wouldn't survive and they'd be back in power very quickly, when that doesn't materialize, assuming it doesn't materialize, then I think we're going to see the challenges become much more overt. One other quick comment. The religious parties were always a part of the coalition that Netanyahu managed. And for them, they're outside the government right now. What matters most to them is monies for their yeshiva. As I said, Avigdor Lieberman, as the finance minister, has made it clear that he intends to cut the childcare allowances for those who don't work. That's targeted only on the religious parties, those, the men who study in yeshiva. And the longer it goes on, that in fact they may be losing out on what matters most to them, the more we may see some defection from the religious parties. Right now, they'll hold out because they want to see if what Bibi said materializes. If it doesn't, their own practical interests may also produce some defections there. There's an old saying, one of the former leaders of the National Religious Parties once said, "We promised to support the prime minister, but we didn't promise to follow the prime minister into the opposition." So we'll see. They're there with him right now. We'll see if that's also durable.
That's fascinating. It certainly makes American politics look simple by comparison. So thanks for the neat exposition. Karim, there have been elections in Iran. We now have a new president, Ibrahim Raisi. Tell us about him. He's reputed to be, quote, the hardliner. What does that actually mean in reality? What's the shape now of Iranian domestic politics? How stable is it? And what does his election mean for Iran's external policy, its posture towards Israel, its posture towards the United States, and, of course, on the JCPOA? Over to you, my friend.
Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be with you and Dennis and Megan. And in many ways, Iranian politics is kind of the opposite of what Dennis was describing about Israeli politics being this new rainbow coalition. The election of Raisi wasn't a rainbow, and it's not a coalition. It's essentially one shade of black with kind of hardline conservatives really consolidating all branches of government. Ibrahim Raisi is best known really as a hanging judge. That's how he got his start in the 1980s when the revolution happened. He was a young cleric and he was appointed to be a judge. And, you know, he's implicated in the execution of thousands of political prisoners. And so that's kind of how he got his start. And over the last decade and a half, he's really risen to where he is now by being an acolyte of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So he's really kind of a mini-me for the supreme leader. And the widespread belief is that he's the most likely individual to succeed Ayatollah Khamenei whenever Khamenei passes. Khamenei is now 82 years old. So I would say internally, we're not really going to witness a lot of change within Iran. It's likely going to become more repressive than it was. And we're witnessing protests now in Khuzestan province in Iran. I've seen some protests even in Tehran and in Tehran Metro. And I think those protests will, like in the past, be met with overwhelming repression. So we should expect internally more repression. Externally, the long-time principles of the Islamic Republic are not going to change. So opposition to America, opposition to Israel's existence, the rivalry with Saudi Arabia, none of those things will change. But I do think external, they'll probably be even a bit more intransigent. And we're already kind of seeing signs of that in the nuclear negotiations with the United States. So if you're the United States or, you know, you're the Europeans, Iran is going to be more difficult to engage. But in some ways, it's going to be a little bit easier to isolate because there's no longer the veneer of a moderate president in Iranian and a moderate Iranian foreign minister in Javad Zarif. And so my expectation is that I think I'd be curious to get Dennis and Megan's take on this. There's growing concern in Washington within the Biden administration that Iran may no longer be interested in returning to the nuclear deal. My belief is that they really can't reverse their economic decline absent a removal of the sanctions. So I do think that they will eventually come back to the nuclear deal. But the hopes of the Biden administration to expand on the nuclear deal to address, you know, Iran's missile program, its drones, its regional ambitions, and prolong the nuclear agreement, I think that's going to be much more difficult.
Your description of Raisi as a Khamenei mini-me is a striking one. And I think you said various shades of black. These are very stark analogies. Could you explain to our audience, how did this come about in terms of the Iranian election itself? Those of us who are casual observers of Iran, in which category I put myself, I'm a China guy, and so I follow Iranian politics only as much as your average semi-intelligent reader. But when we've looked at, for example, in the early Obama period of massive street protests, the dislocations occurring in the economy, popular discontent with the nature and intensity of religious repression, etc., how has this come about? There could be such a convincing win. And has the, shall we say, intensity of the American position against Iran during the Trump administration actually helped materially deliver this particular political outcome in the Iranian elections. Your reflections on that?
Sure. So, you know, this really wasn't, Iranian elections have always had this kind of unique combination of being unfree, unfair, and unpredictable. And what was unique about this election was it was not only unfree and unfair, but it was actually predictable, meaning because of the fact that Ayatollah Khamenei didn't want to take any chances on someone else being elected, they really limited the pool of candidates to Ibrahim Raisi and essentially six political dwarfs, people who had either zero popular appeal or people who were not known in the public. So they didn't want to take any chances. So, you know, that's why I always use the word selection rather than election. You know, Kevin, I think we've had this conversation before. The analogy I sometimes make is that in the 1970s, both the Soviet Union and the Chinese government really had a choice to make. They were kind of at this fork in the road, and they had to decide, do we prioritize, do we double down on our revolutionary ideology, or do we go towards the path of our national and economic interests? Obviously, the Chinese took the path of prioritizing the country's economic interests, and they really transformed themselves. And the Soviet Union continued to double down on revolutionary ideology, and we saw how that story ended. And I think the Islamic Republic, whenever they've had that choice to make over the last 42 years, they've consistently doubled down on repression rather than reform. And I think this, you know, the decision to essentially engineer the election of Ibrahim Raisi was Ayatollah Khamenei again making that that choice. And Khamenei's worldview, it's in fact, you know, similar to the observations made in centuries past by de Tocqueville and Machiavelli, that the most dangerous moment for any bad government is when it tries to reform itself. And so I think for that reason, Khamenei has always felt, and this is the takeaway he learned from the collapse of the Soviet Union, that it happened when Gorbachev, you know, pursued glasnost and perestroika, that actually hastened the demise of the system. So we call people like Raisi and Khamenei, we refer to them, as you said earlier, as hardliners. And they refer to themselves as principalists because they say they're loyal to the principles of the 1979 revolution. And then among those principles are, you know, the slogans of death to America and death to Israel. And so in that respect, we shouldn't expect any changes in Iran's regional posture or its outlook towards the United States.
We're going to take a short break and talk about Asia Society's YouTube channel, where you can find hundreds of videos covering the arts, education, policy, and current events of Asia. Featuring programs from Asia Society's locations across the world, our YouTube channel brings you up to speed on the people and ideas shaping the world's most dynamic region. So hit that subscribe button and get notified every time we post a new video. Earlier this year, President Joe Biden announced that the United States would withdraw its military from Afghanistan by September 11, 2021, 20 years to the day from the 9/11 attacks, which provided the initial justification for America's involvement in the country. In the course of the withdrawal, Taliban forces have recaptured a significant amount of territory from the Afghan government. In the past week, several provincial capitals throughout the country have fallen to the insurgent group. For background on what's happening, here's Megan O'Sullivan, who served as Deputy National Security Advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan under President George W. Bush.
The Biden administration made a decision, announced a couple of months ago, that it would complete the withdrawal that the Trump administration started and committed to, and would complete it. Initially, they said by September 11th. I think people realized that that was a really awkward at best and wildly inappropriate at worst timeline to put it on. It's been changed to August 31st. But the reality is that most American troops are already out of Afghanistan. And this has already led to, I think unraveling is not too dramatic a word to use. The Taliban is now in control of 85% of the country. The Afghan forces, the Afghan military, is proving to be extremely fragile, in some cases, handing over territory to the Taliban without firing a shot. And there's real concern in Kabul about the fragility of the government. And you've heard senior government officials talk about this quite openly. Obviously, there's a lot of concern on the part of Afghan minorities and women and others, Americans and other people around the world who have supported the efforts in Afghanistan, and the people who have really kind of courageously believed that they would be supported by the United States and others if they, you know, they followed in a project that, really was based on the idea that that all elements of society could contribute to government, society, the economy, with education and all kinds of other things. So there's a lot of concern about where this is headed. Let me say a couple of words, because I think this is interesting from the perspective of what this says about the Biden administration and how they're viewing the region at large, but how this decision came about. In some respects, it's not a surprising decision. Anyone who knows President Biden knows that he has been interested in winding down the war in Afghanistan for a long time, actually stood against the Afghan surge that President Obama instituted back in that administration. And part of his campaign was calling for the end of the forever wars and ending the commitment, the military commitment in Afghanistan. However, what is surprising is how this happened and how abrupt it is. And I think it's fair to say how the administration has moved forward so quickly, even in the face of, not being able to answer some very, very key questions. For instance, how America's counterterrorism objectives are going to continue to be met in Afghanistan, even after the withdrawal. Essentially, to make a fairly long story short, this put the president was faced with a difficult decision that former President Trump had put in place a policy, as I mentioned, that had already moved the United States in the direction of a withdrawal, and there were very few troops left on the ground. And President Biden was basically left with the decision of reversing that trajectory or continuing with it. And I think in the face of a couple of arguments, he made the decision he did. And one of the strongest arguments, the one that you hear the most, is that America needs to focus on Asia, needs to focus on China. There was also the argument that there was no peace agreement on the horizon, and that if the United States didn't withdraw this year, it would need to withdraw next year in the absence of a peace agreement, or the year after. I think those rationales may prove to be pretty tenuous over time. I mean, I think the first one is the most important one to examine is, does this withdrawal in fact allow America to focus more squarely on China and on Asia? And Kevin, you of course will have a lot to say about that, and I'd be interested in that. My sense is this is not a very strong argument, in the sense that the commitment that America had in Afghanistan had been dramatically reduced. We're talking about 3,500 troops that had not suffered a casualty for 18 months, that there wasn't necessarily this incredible infusion of political effort or necessarily military support being given to Afghanistan. I think it's fair to say a little bit more would have been necessary to make it sustainable. But what we really needed was a change in the conversation, away from is this about a peace agreement or not, to a conversation about, in fact, is America willing to make a longer term commitment to Afghanistan, a small commitment, but a longer term one, for the purpose of avoiding a bad outcome. Now, this, of course, is a very hard thing to sell to a population that is wary of war with Afghanistan. And I understand how reluctant the administration was to have that conversation. My fear is that Afghanistan is going to deteriorate to the point that it will once again involve or demand the involvement of the Biden administration, and it could become a much bigger distraction from the areas of the world where America's focus is really needed. I was on a congressionally mandated task force on Afghanistan to make recommendations to the new administration, and we heard very clearly intelligence and defense assessments that if America were to withdraw, that the world should expect within 18 to 36 months that groups like Al-Qaeda could reconstitute themselves sufficiently to be a threat to the American homeland. So there, I hope this does not turn out to be the case, but there's certainly the possibility that Afghanistan will once again demand attention from America. And perhaps that attention will be more costly than it would have been to keep a small commitment.
That'll do it for this week's episode of Asia in Depth. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. And check out past episodes by visiting our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Society. I'm Matt Schiavenza. See you next time.